Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. And here is your host, Ryan Mack.
Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Mack. Now, often you hear me talking about how the pandemic has changed consumer behaviors, and you might be thinking, okay, Ryan, that's great, but where is the data? Well, on this episode, we're going to be delivering on that and then some. So on this data-rich episode, I'm joined by Melissa Jankowski, an SVP and division executive for ATM, credit, debit, and software at FIS, and Sarah Grotta, the director of debit and alternative payments advisory service at Mercator Advisor Group. So get ready for a lot of data and insight on this episode. So without any further delays, let's start the show. So Melissa and Sarah, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on today's episode, and I'm really excited to dive into it because I think there's an absolute ton of data to unpack on today's episode. We're really taking a look at U.S. debit and credit here in particular, and kind of a lot of the trends that are emerging and kind of what we're seeing going on in the industry. So certainly a lot of exciting stuff here. So let's dive right into it. So the last few years obviously has certainly been very transformative for the payments industry, as we all know. But let's focus, as we kind of said, on the debit and credit performance side of things. So Melissa, from your data at FIS, can you give us your viewpoint of how debit and credit has performed really kind of over the last 3 years?
Absolutely. Thank you, Ryan, for having me. The past several years absolutely has been transformative for the payments industry. And we've seen multitudes of kind of payment, new payment activity and practices in the last couple of years, driven a lot by the pandemic and some other kind of variables in the economy.
So here at FIS, if I were to take a look at debit and credit from 19 to 20, what I would say is debit is absolutely outgrowing and outperforming credit. The difference in growth, debit was up from a transaction volume perspective by 2.4%. Sales volume was up 15.2% compared to credit, which was down. So if you look at both those metrics, transaction and sales volume, credit was down 7.2% and 4.4% respectively. So very much a difference from how we were trending prior to the pandemic. In contrast, you would ask a question about how is performance in the first quarter or year to date 2021. From a credit perspective, we're seeing growth recovery with transaction volume and sales volume up 10.9% and 16.6% respectively. We also see the spike in both debit transaction and sales volume continuing. In fact, we're seeing debit transaction volume up 31% year to date and sales volume up 44% year to date versus 2020.
Another interesting tidbit, though, that would be interesting to kind of to evaluate is you know, we saw credit volumes decline and debit volumes spike over the last year, but we're also seeing credit card revolving balances decline. In fact, we saw them decline in 2020 by 10.8%. You know, we were looking at some activity, Mercator predicting 3-year recovery period for recapturing the balances that we're seeing decline from the levels of 2019. So far year to date, even in 21, those balances are still trailing, but we do anticipate that it'll take, you know, based on Mercator's predictions, at least a 3-year recovery period for that. The other interesting thing that I would comment on is looking at what merchant category codes we're actually seeing some of the recovery from. And currently, we're seeing good recovery across the board with the exception of travel and entertainment, which still seems to be lagging.
Yeah, that's some fascinating data. I don't know when we have seen shifts in transactions of this magnitude before. There's a couple things that stand out too for me, particularly with debit cards. I think part of it has certainly been the economy, but I think there's also a little bit more of an underlying shift in the types of transactions that we're using debit for. I think we're seeing debit being used for more things like bill pay and subscriptions and also thinking about the use of debit to do things like to maybe fund a P2P app or something like that. So I think it's the economy and also some new uses. And then, you know, you mentioned travel, and this is going to be absolutely fascinating to watch. I think, you know, certainly we hear that people are trying to get back into the mode of traveling. They're itching to get back on a plane and go somewhere. So what does that mean for payment volumes? And I think that will be where I'll be looking to see a bit of a swing potentially back to more credit transactions, or at least an increase in credit card activity, particularly as travel returns.
Agree 100%, which is quite interesting because where we are seeing some credit lift in those categories, it's future travel. So it will be interesting to watch how that trends come, you know, the second half of this year, fourth quarter, and seeing consumer behavior then.
Yeah, and I certainly think, you know, kind of all this is interesting. And I mean, kind of at the end there, really kind of honing in on the travel side of things. And obviously that's clearly an effect of the pandemic. And, you know, a lot of kind of what we're talking about here is just kind of the trends or the kind of the new behaviors that we've seen as a result of the pandemic. But Melissa, you know, I understand that your organization has a PACE survey that specifically took a look at this shift. So let's dive into that survey. And if you could you kind of unpack some of the key highlights that your organization found within that survey?
Absolutely. So, you know, as mentioned, the pandemic certainly drove a lot of that. And, you know, where we're actually seeing some of the lift based on 2020 data is we're seeing 20 to 30% increase in card not present transactions. So the shift is actually being driven towards that card not present environment. And first quarter trends are even demonstrating that that is continuing. So I'm anticipating that we will see quite a bit of activity, and we're really thinking that it's going to continue to move forward in that e-com, MCOM kind of environment. So the electronic and mobile, electronic commerce and mobile commerce environment is where I'm thinking we're going to see the trend. So although we're seeing some of those declines as it relates to, you know, credit transactions and the increase in debit transactions, I think that we're in the same opinion as Visa. The Visa Spring Review, for example, predicted that the five-year CAGR will continue to see a growth of about 3.3% holistically. What's really interesting about that is their prediction is indicating that debit is going to lead the charge in a lot of that growth. They're predicting about a 9.6% CAGR in debit over that five-year period. They're also predicting a 2.8% CAGR for credit. And for all other kind of electronic transactions, they're looking at 2.2. Here's the part that really is really interesting, because through my career, one of the areas that most are chasing their growth from is cash and check. And currently, cash and check, Visa is predicting, is going to see a decline. So for the first time, Visa is predicting about a 12% CAGR decline for cash and check, versus what we're seeing in the card payments and electronic payments environment. So it's a quite interesting period of time, because we're finally doing exactly what we've wanted to do in kind of that contactless, cashless environment. We're starting to take some of that share from cash and check.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting, the growth that we're seeing and also projecting for card not present activity for debit cards in particular. It wasn't that long ago where consumers were really quite concerned about utilizing their debit card in that channel. And certainly, you know, they've gotten over that. But I would say, you know, one thing to issuers is, you know, watch the fraud as well, right? So if you need any sort of reason to get focused on, you know, what you're doing in the fraud area around debit card transactions, now's the time to really get focused, because that shift looks like it's going to continue.
Yeah, and as I'm kind of listening to this part here, the business part of my brain is kind of going like, well, with all of these shifts that are going on in the industry, that to me kind of says like, well, then there's clearly opportunity here. And where such we've kind of, you know, as we're unpacking kind of, there's a large shift that's going on here. So my mind goes, well, are the opportunities even bigger here? So Melissa, let's start with you. From FIS's perspective, really, what do you see as these opportunities now that we've kind of unpacked some of these consumer behavior trends?
Yeah. So in order to kind of start with where we see the opportunity, I'm going to do a little bit of a comparison on kind of two categories or groupings of individuals. I'm going to look at a little bit of Gen Zs versus Gen Xers, if you will. Think about those, the demographics within those categories. 70% of Gen Zers carry a credit card. But what variables are really important to them? Only 40% of them are actually stating that loyalty programs are driving their adoption of that card, versus 85% of Gen Xers carrying a credit card, with 67% of them participating in a loyalty program. What's important to both is that there are no or low fees, but that's a stronger desire for Gen Zs than Gen Xers. Really what the Gen Xers are looking for are cashback programs. So they're looking about where they can generate kind of that incremental value within the product. Both categories, and I would probably state all categories really, are demonstrating an increase in usage of those products in the e-com, m-com kind of environment. So when you kind of unpack that, if you will, from a behavioral data influence perspective, what does that mean? We've focused on a couple of different solutions that provide incremental convenience to the end user as we look at what the value propositions are and how you can influence those individuals that are driven by loyalty programs in order to adopt the product. So we're really focusing on things like digital experience through digital issuance strategies, buy now, pay later options, the enhancement of loyalty solutions for all products, including debit, and the value propositions and how you can encourage the consumer to get engaged with that loyalty program, because those are really the things that are going to drive preference of that solution and get the top of wallet status that most financial institutions are looking for out of their cardholder.
Yeah, you know, I hear a lot of issuers talking about debit rewards again, where I think for a while we had a bit of a lull. And, you know, always then you talk a little bit about the business case, right? How do you make that happen? How does that work? And I think part of it has been a little bit of a shift of the mindset about debit rewards. And it's not just looking at the return on the debit card transaction, but looking at it a little bit more holistically around the relationship, looking at the opportunity to, capture more of the overall transaction activity, maybe keeping a few more transactions away from the fintechs, if you will, and also keeping more balances within the financial institution.
You know, if I could, I want to circle back a little bit kind of to the PACE survey that your organization has, Melissa, here. Because one of the things, just from kind of a personal standpoint, I'm interested in, and I think that you see a lot in the news, is kind of the differences between the millennial generation and the boomer generation here. Because I think a lot of people put a lot of focus into those particular two generations and kind of like, how are they behaving as consumers? So looking particularly at the PACE survey from your organization, what can you tell me about kind of some of the differences or trends or some of the things that are similar between these two generations?
Yeah, I think what you're going to find is that most are similar in kind of what they're looking. They're looking for convenience, honestly. And when you think about, you know, how consumers are transacting and what they're doing in order to, you know, deliver the value that they need and the convenience that they need, I think you're going to find that you're going to see a lot of the same behaviors. We touched a little bit on this a little bit earlier. When we started talking about digital commerce and that representing essentially the growth that we saw in 2020, McKinsey even indicated that we should anticipate at least 70% of all volume and transaction growth to come from e-commerce or in-commerce transactions through 2023, which is staggering. So, when you think about how people are leveraging their product, I think it's really important to know that most of them are looking for that convenience factor. And that convenience factor is really going to drive the behavior. Even though one type of credit product might be demanded over another type of credit product, depending on what that generation is really looking for out of the solution. What I would say too is let's go back to cash. Remember when we were talking a little bit about, you know, taking share from cash? The question is cash going to find its way back? And if you look at some of the trends that we're seeing now, 2019, for example, cash represented 14.6% of the transactions at the point of sale versus mobile wallets. And mobile wallets only represented about 6%. In 2020, cash saw a decline and went to 11.4%. Mobile wallet increased and went to 9.6. So far this year, cash is declining even more. Now it's at 9.7% of the spend versus the wallet at 15.5. So the displacement of cash really is driving how consumers are wanting to spend. I would put less focus on the generational differences between, you know, the loyalty programs that drive adoption of that product, but on how their experiences are that's going to create the convenience that the financial institution needs to generate that loyalty and top of wallet status.
Yeah, no, Melissa, thank you so much for that. I think it's certainly very interesting. And I think a very valid point there at the end of like, don't necessarily look at it as kind of a generational situation here. If you are able to provide the experience and value for it, it's going to kind of go cross-generational, if you will, because us as human beings, that's really what we're looking for at the end of the day, no matter what your age is for that. But one of the interesting things that I heard you kind of bring up there was kind of that McKinsey statistic there in terms of e-commerce here. Because I think when we take a look at overall trends, especially that have been created by the pandemic, is especially the rise of e-commerce and m-commerce. Now, obviously from e-commerce, we knew like, hey, yes, it is on the rise. We were starting to see, especially during the holiday seasons, more people kind of, you know, going e-commerce versus going to the in-store and avoiding all the crowds, which I am in huge favor of doing. But I'm curious now, let's dive into that particular part of it a little bit, right? So what is it that your data is showing beyond kind of that 70% rise of e-commerce here of kind of that e-commerce and e-commerce space? What are you seeing from your perspective, Melissa?
When we're looking at, you know, the behaviors around e-com and e-commerce for the consumer behavior, I think that you're really looking at purchasing power and convenience. And so focusing on solutions that allow us to provide that control over how the product works. It provides the convenience of how they want to pay. It provides the demand. You know, what is their open to buy and what is their power of purchase, their purchasing power in order to drive consumption. I think those are kind of the variables that have to be considered in all of the environments, which is one of the reasons we're focusing on, you know, digital issuance, one of the reasons we're focusing on buy now, pay later, and one of the reasons we're focusing on the loyalty solutions, and specifically with debit based on the growth trends that we're seeing around debit. So again, if you can provide the consumer with the power to control their experience, I think that you're going to be able to create the loyalty and the stickiness with that client.
You know, Melissa, you brought up a couple things there, particularly buy now, pay later, which obviously we've certainly seen a lot of headlines in regards to buy now, pay later and kind of the usage and adoption of that. But let's take a look at that. But then also, you know, at the beginning of our conversation, we also talked about debit rewards. So I'd like to bring that into the conversation as well too, and do a little bit deeper dive, particularly around those two areas here. So maybe kind of from FIS's perspective, what is it you're seeing with buy now, pay later, and then also debit rewards?
Absolutely. So starting with buy now, pay later, just taking a little bit of a step back, you know, what does the solution provide for consumers? And really, it's that purchasing power that we've been talking about. They decide how their funds are being leveraged and spent, and they decide, you know, when they want to have a larger open to buy with maybe a payment on the back end based on their consumption ideas. what I would say is consumers have always kind of operated in kind of the three different pay strategies. You have pay now, which is that debit environment. You have pay later, which is the credit environment. And you have the pay before, which is prepaid environment. And so with those concepts of acquisition or payment from a consumption perspective, you know, buy now, pay later can fit within that debit and or credit realm. And so how we've been looking at it is we want to be able to provide the consumer the convenience of choosing how and when they pay and when they leverage that open to buy, you know, consumption power that they have. And so we're looking at it a couple of different ways. I would start with, we're working with the global networks that have the ability to integrate into the point of sale. And by integrating into the point of sale, the consumer is given the option to actually open their open to buy greater than what they may have on that debit or credit product, because they then can choose at the point of sale, as long as there is a participating issuer, financial institution, or merchant. But they're able to state or identify at the point of sale, I want this piece of the transaction to go into a payment or installment plan, which then allows them a greater, you know, purchasing power based on what they've already got available in the other payment vehicle, whether it be debit or credit. So the second option is allowing consumers to transact as normal at the point of sale, but then after the consumption, after the transaction has occurred, they can go in and elect portions of their transaction to go into an installment program. So by giving them that flexibility, they can decide later that that transaction needs to be on a payment solution or a payment plan. The reason this is exciting is because it provides the consumer options. It gives them more spending power when the need arises. And it also provides them some flexibility in those circumstances where the purchase was because of a surprise or an unplanned event. So these options certainly are opening up to consumers to be able to transact in real time with decisions on how those transactions are going to impact their financial, you know, position or situation. So when we think about debit rewards, you know, this is an important component in attracting and retaining new debit card holders. McKinsey found that financial institutions launch debit loyalty programs saw about a 54.9% increase in their annualized spend and 13.2% increase in balance for the demand deposit account those cardholders were participating in. Those are significant statistics when you think about why financial institutions want to attract debit customers. You know, they're looking for the deposits. The deposits create the value across the organization. And so those relationships certainly have an incremental value to them. So as we think about debit loyalty programs, we want to be able to look at, you know, how that debit program is going to drive consistent behavior month over month and continued consumptions. And traditionally within the everyday spend categories, gas, groceries, you know, the expenses that consumers have on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. And so when we think, you know, what's going to drive the value to the cardholder to adopt the debit program for the loyalty program, it has to be something where the cardholder sees the value almost immediately. It can't be similar to a credit portfolio that might have a longer term to be able to generate, interest and then the usability of those points or the value. On debit, it needs to be almost in real time. So when I think about debit programs and some of the ideas of why debit programs work, I think of things like having a financial institution look at different examples of what would drive spend behavior. Spend $100 in a specific merchant category code, receive a $5 Starbucks card, for example. Relationship rewards. So allow the the relationship within the financial institution to drive the adoption of points that then can turn into value. Conduct a certain number of transactions in a particular period of time and earn dining, travel, entertainment, anything that might spark some interest in order to drive, again, top of wallet status with regular and consistent usage of that product. Participation by the consumer in a loyalty program is what will drive the increased spend, deposits, and retention that the financial institution is looking for from the program.
If I could ask you just one more question about that. When we think about these two things, the debit rewards and loyalty, and also the buy now, pay later opportunities, and then sort of tie that back into something you talked about earlier, which was some of the generational differences, or maybe the lack of generational differences. Are you seeing adoption of these two particular solutions being treated differently by different generations, or is it similar to what you were discussing earlier, where these are great opportunities across generations?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm actually seeing anything different from a generational perspective. I think value is value. And when it comes to loyalty programs, sometimes I like to say cash is king, but in the debit world, really what consumers are looking for is something that might benefit them sooner rather than later, which is why the example of spend $100, at your grocery store and receive a $5 Starbucks card or a $5 McDonald's card or, something that's going to allow immediate consumption. So I think it's just value, and behavior can be predicted based on these loyalty programs when there are options around them. So, what I mean by that is the consumer will, if they've got a choice as to how they get that $5 reward, for example, let's say they generate the interest or the ability to get that $5 reward within a 7-day period versus 6 months from now, that time frame is what's really driving the behavior. Then I think you're going to find that the consumer is going to lean on that product a little bit more than one that didn't have something that they were getting from a value perspective. So if I might, I'd like to have just one more thought around buy now, pay later, since we did a little bit of an analysis and a compare from a generational perspective on debit loyalty. When you think about buy now, pay later, we are seeing some trends where the adoption seems to be more within the millennial grouping. They are less likely to adopt a credit card. And so this group, the buy now, pay later solution really is acting as an entry point for them into feeling comfortable with a credit product. The difference between a credit card and buy now, pay later really is about the terms and the ability to set the term for when that balance will be paid off. So it provides a little bit more clarity around, being able to pay it off versus having it spiral out of control or feel like, it's a never-ending payment cycle. So, one of the values of buy now, pay later is that the consumer is in control of how that is determined, and they get to decide when and how it gets paid back.
I think that that's just a really great statistic, especially as we kind of look more towards digitization, kind of that top of wall of status is always going to be kind of a paramount issue to it. I mean, my mind, and I know that this isn't directly related, is that you've got that, but I kind of also question when you get into the IoT payment side of things and brands kind of start to disappear into the background, that top of wallet status is going to be, if you're not top of wallet, you don't exist. Essentially at that point, because you're going to have that card on file, and then
exactly.
That's it. You're going to say, Alexa, pay for my insert product here. and whatever card's on file, well, that's it. Unless, of course, they get into some kind of smart routing that looks at, you know, well, how much do you have in this account? What are your rewards going to be and all that fun stuff? But that's future talk at that point. I think a good place of
Love it, Ryan.
we'll have
yeah,
to,
I was going to say, I mean, feeding into that, I love that. The Internet of Things is a whole nother kind of component of dialogue. And I absolutely love that. And even though, you know, changing card preference within wallets is easier today than it had been in the past, the fact that a loyalty program on debit could put you, I mean, it puts you 40.5% most likely top of wallet status. You know, if it increases the potential there, what I would say is that's the case, especially with Internet of Things. When we start adding credit cards to our car and we have Alexa in our homes, being top of wallet for those types of purchases, those on-demand, you know, voice-generated purchases is more paramount than ever as to a reason why you want to ensure that you're giving every opportunity to gain that position of top of wallet. So absolutely another great reason why debit loyalty programs are going to be strong. So that was a great point, Ryan.
One of the other things, just kind of while we're in that vein of it, that I think is particularly interesting is also then when you kind of take a look at instant issuance there, because I've got a current experience where I was told, hey, you know, this might be a fraudulent transaction. And I was like, yes, it was. And they're like, oh, okay, well, we'll close this account. We'll send you a new card. 5 business days for a card. You don't think I'm going to change my consumer behaviors in 5 days? You are sadly mistaken. So it's like you need to get that digital issuance right then and there, especially as it relates to the IoT of things, because people aren't going to wait. They're going to go like, okay,
that's
like,
exactly
the rewards or whatever, those are nice, but I have a need now. Like, so I'm going to find the next available card that's there or whatever payment vehicle it is I want, and I'm going to use that. And it's always kind of surprised me, especially from some of the bigger financial institutions, that if they know that I've got my card within a digital wallet, why they don't instantly issue me that digital issuance and be like, hey, we know you've got a mobile wallet. We're going to put it in there. So you have at least a temporary card. Within a couple of days, you'll get the actual physical card. So we know that you're going to keep using it. But that's my personal story.
Hey, Ryan, what I would say is the pandemic has changed the opinion around that. So pushing those credentials out now is more important than ever. You know, as you think about that, as you think about contactless, the rationale around tokenization, so that you don't necessarily have to reissue the entire card. You just have to deactivate a token and reissue a new token when that new transaction at the same MCC occurs. So the technology is certainly making it easier to do that, so consumers don't have to change their behaviors. And it's exciting to see, you know, in kind of real time, how the value of those programs are actually working and the reason we're moving and shifting so quickly through that technology.
Yeah. And to your point, I mean, that also then kind of brings up when you take a look at the tokenization side of things is how many subscription services it is that a person subscribes to and they have that card on file. Well, again, in my instance, okay, the account gets closed because due to fraud, as opposed to being like, well, we'll just change out tokens for you. So that way then you can continue to use your account. I now have to go through all my subscription services and renew them. And then me as the merchant, that's a dangerous situation because then I start to sit there and think, do I really need this subscription service? Or when's the last time I used this thing? As opposed to, nope, it reissues it. I've got it. I've got the service or whatever it is that I need again. And I don't really think about it. It's kind of a passive payment there. All right. So Melissa and Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode as we really took a deep dive into debit and credit card use and consumer behavior usage within them. And I hope to have both of you back on the podcast real soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, Ryan.